Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Pentagon announced changes late last week that would formally sign off on changes that are already happening. Women in the U.S. military moving much closer to combat, often into combat in Iraq and Afghanistan, where combat can explode anywhere. When it does, women are already there with their rifles. But policy matters. This hour on Point, women, combat, the rules, and the U.S. military. You can join the conversation. How do you feel about women in combat roles in the U.S. military? Service women, have you already been there? Are the rules right? Should there be a boundary? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We will go to women in combat in a moment, but first we look at a report today that the country's top special forces commander is seeking authority to move U.S. special operations forces faster and outside regular deployment channels anywhere in the world. It's a New York Times report today. Reporter Eric Schmidt is one of its authors. He's co-author of Counterstrike, The Untold Story of America's Campaign Against Al-Qaeda. He joins us from Washington. Eric Schmidt, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
What is this top commander, in this case, Admiral William McRaven, what's he seeking for the Special Forces?
Well, what Admiral McRaven is trying to do is get more authority for him to be able to deploy or pre-position Special Operations Forces around the world. Right now, about 80% or so of Special Operations Forces have been in the Middle East, places like Afghanistan and Iraq, and as conventional forces come out of those countries, they're already out of Iraq and have come out of Afghanistan. McRaven is looking, and the country is really looking, to utilize special operations forces to combat and confront the developing threats that are around the world. So what McRaven wants to be able to do is has the authority to kind of position these special elite forces, these are like Navy SEALs and Army Rangers, in advance in countries where there have been fewer numbers of them up till now, in places like Asia, Latin America. He wants to have the flexibility to put them in places where they could be used by the regional commanders should the need arise.
That may be a good thing, but when you say, you know, moving special forces, moving the U.S. military faster and with more autonomy, a lot of people may be thinking about how quickly we get into military encounters. Why does he need more speed? What's the argument for more speed and more autonomy here? Why not have the regular oversight?
Well, right now what happens when you need special operations forces or any other kind of military forces, the military has to go through a rather time-consuming process where the regional commander, that is the part of the world that needs these troops, puts in a request, it's funneled through the Pentagon, it's assessed, and then the forces are approved or not. And that's fine if you don't have a crisis brewing. What McRaven is saying is, look, let's have some of these forces in different parts of the world ready to go should that regional commander make that call, and it'll cut the time down that you need to actually deploy them. They'll be in position if they're needed, and these could be anything from the commandos, such as those that killed Osama bin Laden last May, but they also could be special forces, Green Berets, who are used as trainers in different countries, which are becoming more popular again.
Eric, you report that similar plans in the past have not gone forward because of opposition from regional commanders and the State Department. What's the source of their opposition to this faster, more autonomous Special Forces deployment?
Well, they're not necessarily opposed to what McRaven is offering now, but they're looking at what's happened in the past when other plans, not this one, were put into place without full consultation of either the regional military commanders or, more seriously, the ambassadors in various countries. There was some time in the mid-2000s where small numbers of these kind of special operations forces were inserted into countries without the ambassador even knowing about it, and that caused quite a controversy among the military and State Department before it was sorted out. McRaven is conscious of that and is working his way through not only with his military colleagues, but he'll work through with the State Department, the White House officials as well.
We'll see. For the last decade, 80% of Special Forces deployed in the Middle East. He's looking for much wider deployments, Asia, Africa, Latin America. Why?
Well, these are the places where you see trouble spots popping up. I mean, just look at what's going on in Africa now with the fallout from Arab Spring in northern Africa. You still have concerns in Somalia and eastern Africa. And you have a new a new Islamic insurgency called Boko Haram in northern Nigeria. So there are places outside the areas where U.S. forces have been deployed in large numbers where McRaven is saying, hey, we may need smaller numbers of these elite forces to help stamp out trouble before it escalates.
How does this line up with the sort of Ron Paul vision of the world? Don't be the world's policeman. Let's pull back. Let's not get involved, entangled.
Well, obviously, it runs counter to that. But again, McRaven and others who support this are saying, look, in a world of declining defense budgets, in a world when the large numbers of American troops are coming home, he and others are saying, look, we can use small numbers of these elite special forces and special operations forces to maybe head off trouble before it escalates into these larger problems, or to go in and, if you need to, take out terrorists with small teams rather than large armies, as the U.S. has had to rely upon in Iraq and Afghanistan over the last decade.
A quiet, but it sounds like intense lobbying campaign going on right now to push through that initiative that would permit faster and more autonomous deployment and assignment of U.S. special forces around the world. That's something to keep an eye on. Eric Schmidt reports on it today with Mark Mazzetti and Tom Shanker in the New York Times. Eric, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Andrew Tillman joins us now as we turn to women and combat. He's senior writer for Military Times, publishes Army Times, Navy Times, Marine Corps Times, and Air Force Times. Andrew Tillman, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
Everybody's head was turned by the headlines last week. It's kind of subtle, but there's a lot of evolution going on this front. What was raised last week? What's the change that's on the table now for women and combat roles in the military, Andrew?
Well, this change has been under discussion for a while, and I think what was interesting about it is that it was extremely incremental. What they basically did is lifted the rules that were technically restricting women from co-locating with combat troops. And really what this is, this allows support troops like medics or administrative troops or intelligence specialists to serve alongside combat units. And really what this is just the policy catching up with the reality, because women who have those jobs have been serving alongside combat units for years in Iraq and Afghanistan. It was just a question of whether they were technically, quote-unquote, attachments and not actually assigned to those units. So it's really the change in practice will not be extraordinary.
Because of the experience on the ground of women and men in Iraq and Afghanistan, but this is saying that they can be permanently assigned now to combat battalions, and that before was just a temporary assignment.
Right, exactly. They can be assigned to these units, and they can be, in hindsight, formally recognized as having served in these units. And I think that's, in some ways, from a lot of the women I talked to, their primary concern is because they were basically before serving in combat-type roles, and then when it came time for promotions and things like that, they weren't being recognized for having done so. So in some ways, this is a welcome step, even though it may be a limited step.
Andrew, we've talked with a lot of women in preparation for this show who've served and said, look, you know, and are serving now and saying, gosh, we're out in the thick of it all the time. Formally, what is the boundary here? Is there a boundary now about women in combat in the U.S. military? Is there some line that's not supposed to be crossed? What is it?
Well, right now, technically, that is women are not allowed to be assigned to the actual combat arms career fields. Women cannot be infantrymen. They can't serve in artillery units or tank units. Those are still going to continue to be all-male units. But, you know, I mean, the reality of Iraq and Afghanistan is one where that's it's just a very kind of ambiguous distinction at this point, because the rule that was drawn up was last revised in 1994, and it's basically a Cold War era definition of a combat troop, as though there was a front line and a rear that you can withdraw to. That doesn't exist in Iraq and Afghanistan, so that's why this policy has seemed so outdated.
144 female U.S. troops have died in Iraq and Afghanistan in those conflicts. 865 have been wounded. I guess that's certainly the evidence that they've been in harm's way. I mean, they are carrying arms, and they are right out there in transport troops and, as you say, attached to a lot of these battalions. But the concern has been raised among women, career military women, that because of the restrictions that have remained, their promotion in their careers has suffered. Is there evidence of that?
Yeah, I think there is. I mean, the women make up about 15% of the entire force, but with the senior flag and general officers at the Pentagon, they really only make up about 7%. So, you know, it's not a huge issue in the mid-career ranks, but certainly at the very senior levels, It's the guys who were involved in combat. It was the trigger pullers. It was the people that were managing, the brigade-level combat units. Those are the guys that get promoted into the general officer positions, and that's something that women have been excluded from.
Andrew, will this affect different services differently, Army, Navy, Marines, Air Force?
It will, yeah. It will be affecting the Army most. Interestingly, the Marines had not been really enforcing this co-location restriction, and the Marines had been sending women out with foot patrols in Iraq and Afghanistan for years because they found that women were very helpful in getting intelligence from, you know, in local villages. They would be able to speak to the local women in a way that men might not be able to. So it's really only adding a couple of hundred jobs to the Marine Corps, whereas the Army had been, in some technical way, much more restrictive. So it's going to add, I think, about 14,000 jobs for female soldiers.
We've heard some controversy around this in the U.S. Over the weekend since it was announced. What about in the military itself? Is this non-controversial? Are people sort of past this? They've already seen it, more or less in effect, in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Yeah, I think that there's the sense that there's kind of, there's the technical stuff that's on the books at the Pentagon, and then there's the reality of the way things play out in the field. And, people that have been, deploying to Iraq and Afghanistan know the roles that women have been playing. And I think it's, women welcome this as a bureaucratic move, but I just don't really think that in practice it's going to have that much effect on how things are done downrange. And as a result, I don't think this is really a huge issue inside the military at this point.
Andrew Tillman, senior writer with Military Times. Thanks for joining us, Andrew.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about women and combat in the U.S. military. New rules are acknowledging what's already been happening in Iraq and Afghanistan. Women have often been in the thick of it. We're asking how far this should, will go this hour. Here's a female engagement team of 19 women deploying with the South Carolina Army National Guard to Afghanistan for the first time this year. The mission, to gain the trust of local women there, Sergeant Scarlett Martinez speaks.
Sometimes the men, they see us as, why are the females part of the infantry now? But for them, they're starting to realize that we're an asset to them.
An asset to them. Major Sergeant Rick Turner with the South Carolina Army National Guard speaks here.
The truth is the truth. American females are on the front lines. The American populace know this. They're on the front lines and they're doing the same thing and fighting the same war equally as their American male soldier.
And have been for some years now in Iraq and Afghanistan in many, many circumstances. We're going to dive in and look at this today. Joining us from Washington, first, Margaret Harrell, senior fellow and director of the Joining Forces Initiative at the Center for New American Security. She's looked closely at the role of women in the military. Margaret, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And from Washington, Kayla Williams is with us, sergeant in Iraq from 2003 to 2004. She served as an Arabic interpreter. She's author of Love My Rifle More Than You, Young and Female in the U.S. Army. Kayla Williams, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. It's a pleasure to be here.
Margaret Harrell, first to you. What's being acknowledged in these new steps being taken by the U.S. military?
Well, I think the main thing that's being acknowledged is that the situation in Iraq and Afghanistan is very different from any situation in which we fought before. A lot of our policies about where military women could serve were based on the presumption that there were safe areas and not safe areas, and that's just not the case in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Kayla Williams, what was your experience in Iraq when it comes to lines, front lines, back lines, and lines of function, women carrying the rifle and using it?
I took part of the initial invasion of Iraq in 2003 and went out on combat foot patrols with the infantry in Baghdad. I had no plates in my flak vest because they assumed that as a female, I wouldn't need them. But when it came right down to it, what they needed was somebody who could communicate between U.S. soldiers and the local people. So I went out, I did my job, and I did it well. I believe any of the infantrymen that I walked alongside would have rather had me there with them, female or not, than to not have an interpreter at all. And for the rest of my time that I was there, I spent time with every unit in our division, got tossed around all over the place, was often very forward deployed. And during combat operations, my gender was never an issue, only the skills that I brought to the table.
No plates in your flak vest, meaning no armored plates in there. I don't understand that. If you're on foot patrol along with, patrols going out into rough situations, does that say that they were somehow keeping you at the rear of their patrols?
No.
How could you have no plates?
What it says is, you may recall the phrase, you go to war with the army you have.
Yeah.
And I got them later, but during the initial invasion, they did not issue them to me.
Were there restrictions on your activity on those foot patrols? Were you just there to translate? Were you a trigger puller?
Everyone is a soldier first. If we had come under fire, I absolutely would have been called upon to return fire just as much as anyone else. We've had females die in combat already, as you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
There's also been one female awarded the Silver Star for her valor in combat in Iraq and another in Afghanistan. So clearly women are expected to do their duties as soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines, just like their male counterparts.
Margaret Harrell, Kayla Williams, as a sergeant in Iraq, was an interpreter there. What other kinds of roles have brought women into combat situations in this last decade, Margaret?
Well, what's very interesting is a lot of the occupations that have more of our women proportionately are occupations that in previous wars we would have thought were further back from the front. So a lot of the support, the logistics, the supply, the fuel handlers, there's a lot of women in those positions. And the reality is in Iraq and Afghanistan, these types of forces are right up with all the other forces. They're all intermixed.
But, I mean, I'm just trying to get a picture. For those of us who haven't been out there, we see some of these forward bases in Afghanistan, you know, way up on the side of a mountain in the middle of nowhere. In footage I've seen of that, I haven't typically seen women there. When is there still sex segregation?
Well, there's really not a lot of sex segregation because if you think about those forward operating bases, logistics have to get to them. And when mm-hmm. the supply convoys come, there's women in those supply convoys. And that's how we've had a lot of women come under fire and have engagements with the enemy. And that's why we have a lot of women, for example, that have earned the combat action badge.
Back in 2003, mm-hmm. I spent 6 weeks on the side of a mountain at a listening post observation post with about 7 male troops, and then another few months on the other side of the same mountain with about 20 male troops. So I was at one of those very remote outposts, and there was no difference in the circumstances I lived in than those of the men that I served alongside.
Margaret, Kayla, the sister of one of my producers here at On Point is an Army captain deployed in Afghanistan. And when we were talking with her about this via email, and she said, you know, I mean, the current policy just seems obsolete. She wrote to us that they're, you know, making a big deal about women serving in ground combat units is almost a little insulting, she said. It discredits those of us who've been doing it all along. She said, as a woman who's been in combat and led others into combat, I do not think women should be restricted from any position for which they're mentally, emotionally, and physically qualified. She writes, lifting the ban on women in ground combat should ensure a more gender-neutral policy, hopefully allowing a more capable military. Is that where we're headed, Margaret?
Well, we're partway there. Andrew Tillman spoke about the co-location restriction that's been lifted, and that did open about 13,000 of the positions that are newly open to women. But the other change that's been enacted is an exemption to the policy that previously had kept women from being assigned to combat arms units at the battalion level. And now that has been exempted in the Army for 9 brigade combat teams. Women can be formally assigned to the battalions within those combat units. So we're partway there now.
Kayla, do you see the remaining restrictions on American women's combat roles in the military as a career problem for women who devote their careers to the military? Does it put a sort of a brass ceiling, I've seen it called, on women's careers?
Yes, I definitely think that that can be part of the problem. Another aspect to the issue, in my opinion, is that by preventing women from serving in combat arms jobs, by keeping us out of the infantry, it institutionalizes a perception that we are second-class soldiers. And I believe that encourages tacitly sexual harassment by portraying us as not real soldiers in every situation.
That's interesting. We'll look at that aspect. Margaret, is this ultimately, though, is it really about equal opportunity in a career sense, or is it about U.S. military capacity in combat?
Well, I think it's about U.S. military capability and giving our military commanders the most flexibility they can have as to how best to use their people. And as we head to a force that's going to be downsized, the challenges of a downsized force will require greater flexibility, being able to use the people that you have the best way that you can to their greatest capability.
What about those, Kayla, who say there are physical differences between men and women, and so, you know, just size-wise, let's say, and so let's not take this line down. It's important.
There are physical differences between genders, but also within genders and between different age groups. If there are certain jobs or certain theaters of operation in which there are very stringent physical requirements, I support applying those across the board. If there is a male who is too weak or due to his age or size or whatever else to perform certain skills, then he too should be banned from that job or that theater. But if a woman is physically capable, there's no reason that she shouldn't be out there. You heard earlier from somebody who's about to deploy as a member of a female engagement team, one of the callers that you had. And we are already out there because we can provide very special skills. We can be an asset, especially in counterinsurgency operations in Muslim countries, where our ability to communicate with the female half of the population is absolutely vital. Women are already out there carrying the same weight, walking alongside men in those mountains. We're proving every day that we can do it.
There's tradition leaning against it. There's fact and reality now in Iraq encompassing it sounds like, in many days, in many places. There's a death toll. 144 female troops have died in those wars, 865 wounded, which tells us something in itself. Margaret Harrell, Kayla Williams, please stand by in Washington. I want to bring Robert McGinnis into our conversation, retired from the Army as Lieutenant Colonel in 93. He was a senior strategist in the U.S. Army. He's now a senior fellow for national security at the Family Research Council, conservative Christian group, lobbies on all kinds of fronts. He's a columnist for Human Events, a conservative news site. Robert McGinnis, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, Tom.
You must have seen what's going on in Iraq and Afghanistan, women stepping up into all kinds of roles in those theaters. Now, there's some moving of the boundaries just last week that will formalize some of those changes and bring them within the ambit of military rules. Should this go further, Robert? If women are picking up the gun and putting on the muscle and going out into combat, should we take down the formal restrictions?
I don't think so, Tom. No, I appreciate the civil discussion and certainly the issues of, you know, women being engaged and wounded and killed and being heroic on the battlefield. There's no question about what's happened in Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, my concern is, where does this lead? As Margaret indicated, there's been incrementalism, and I've been around the Army for more than four decades and have seen that incrementalism. Some, I think, has been very good. The next step, though, I'm very concerned about. As an infantryman, a ranger, and I've been in Iraq a couple of times, and I follow this very closely, I'm very concerned that ultimately we are going to dismiss the real issues that discriminate between men and women in this type of environment. And that environment, by the way, is changing again. And ultimately, I believe that we will end up with conscription. I do believe that our young women in a future time will be conscripted for combat. And I don't think we need to go that far. Yes, young women are contributing greatly. They are in the mix this day. And probably until Afghanistan is over, we'll continue to have that. But as the president said in announcing his new strategy last month, you know, stability ops, counterinsurgencies, that's something we're not going to be really engaged in the future. We will have counterterrorism activities. We're going back to more conventional type of battle. So, you know, do we adapt to the current battle or do we adapt to the future battle if, in fact, the president's strategy is correct?
Robert McGinnis, what are the real issues that you say you fear would be dismissed around this subject?
If, in fact, we were to treat young women just like young men in regard to the future in a combat arena, then we have to consider the physical issue, you know, the cardiovascular, the upper body's fitness, the you know, what you see on TV is not an anomaly. You know, you see these young troops carrying 80-pound packs in the mountains of Afghanistan day in and day out, and then they go into spurts of extreme violence, and they have to demonstrate considerable physical capability. And keep in mind, we always govern by categories of people, and we don't govern by individuals that happen to excel. Now, the other nations, like Canada, they went through an interesting experiment as a direct result of what their human rights tribunal dictated. And they recruited a bunch of women, put them through infantry training, and one graduated. They do have women in combat units today, and the data is very, very slim on how they are performing in the, as infantrymen. And that's something that I would hope that any future commission would look like. But then there's also the issue, certainly, of mixing the genders. I heard what one of your guests said. I certainly have seen this firsthand. And my concern...
Seen what?
The sexual tension issues. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody heard about Rick Santorum's statement the other day, you know, that basically said that there is some sort of hardwiring in men to protect young women. Well, there's some of that, but there's also the sexual tension and what that does in forced intimate situations. I don't think we should dismiss the fact that young people bring their libidos with them into the battlefield, and that becomes a factor that we have to seriously consider, especially if you look at the evidence with regard to, you know, we do pass out contraceptives in the battlefield because we do know people engage in sex, and that leads to not only pregnancies, but it also leads to jealousies and morale issues, things that are the local commander, whether they be a platoon leader, a squad leader, or a division commander, are concerned about.
And Robert McGinnis, stand by for one moment, if you would. We've got a couple big things on the table. Let me take them to Margaret and Kayla. Margaret Harrell, first to you. Let's go first to the physical issue, just strength, 80-pound packs, humping them around the mountains of Afghanistan, and then bouts of extreme violence. Should that in and of itself put women out of that arena?
To date, women in Iraq and Afghanistan are performing just as well as their male peers. All reports back from commanders that we hear say that there's really not a problem.
But are they being asked to do the same things, carry those same 80-100-pound packs, participate in those same firefights?
They are being asked to do the same things, as they should. They're carrying their own load and their own weight.
Kayla, what's your experience on that front? I mean, if it really comes down to it, full members of combat units, does the physical issue create a barrier?
Again, if there are physical requirements, they should be applied across the board. So if you have to be able to carry an 80-pound pack 10 miles, then every male who goes into that unit should also have to pass that same test before deploying. The Army is in the middle of developing a combat readiness test. It involves hurdles, a high crawl, a casualty drag, several other tests. Everyone who deploys should be held to the same standard on that, because it doesn't matter if you're a supply sergeant. If your vehicle gets hit, you need to be able to return fire and drag an injured person out of the Humvee to a safe zone if that is necessary. So are there men who can't do it? Absolutely. Keep them out of the truck, too.
Robert McGinnis, we just have a minute before the break, but Margaret and Kayla are saying, you know, A, women are doing it already, and B, let's decide it by individual physical capacity.
Well, I certainly believe that if women were put in that position, they would have to. I have no evidence that women are carrying 80-pound backs in Afghanistan. Never seen it, and I've spent a lot of time following this issue. I can't give me the data. I'd like to see it. I can tell you that the Canadians tried it, and one out of 26 that went through that special training only passed. There may be one out there, but you know, to manage a 1.5 million person organization by individuals rather than categories is very difficult.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about women and combat in the U.S. military. New rules, as of last week, are acknowledging what's already happening in Iraq and Afghanistan. Women have often been in the thick of it, and we're asking today how far this should, will, Go. Robert McGinnis is with us, retired from the Army as a lieutenant colonel, senior strategist in the U.S. Army. He's now columnist for Human Events and senior fellow for national security at the Family Research Council. Margaret Harrell is with us, senior fellow, director of the Joining Forces Initiative at the Center for New American Security. And Kayla Williams is with us, a sergeant in Iraq for the invasion there 2003-2004, author of Love My Rifle More Than You, Young and Female in the U.S. Army. Rick Santorum talking about women and men and combat, saying there were emotional issues. He came back later to say there were men's emotional issues, not women's.
Men who are, you know, who are certainly in our culture are, you know, are focused on if a woman is in trouble, obviously to react, to try to protect and care for that person. That's something that is built in culturally. It's built in and so my concern is that being in combat in that situation, instead of focused on the mission, they may be more concerned about protecting someone who may be in a vulnerable position, a woman in a vulnerable position.
Rick Santorum thinking about emotional complications on the field of combat. Let's go to our listeners. Bourne, Massachusetts, Jack is calling. Jack, thanks, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
Just, you know, as a dad of three kids that currently serve, I have a daughter that's a Marine Corps captain, two tours in Fallujah and one in Afghanistan. She was one of the original FET team commanders. She trained 50 Marines, to go over to Afghanistan.
Yeah.
It was about a 6 months training thing. She did the whole training, you know, everything from, you know, where they did learning Pushtun, local culture.
Yes.
They all had to be, what she basically did was train them so they can be at least what the average platoon male, you know, could do, for a tour. And these women were out there for 6 months at a time, you know, going down, dirt roads, checking for, IEDs, no air conditioning, no bathrooms, anything like that, the same as the guys.
In the thick of it. So what do you think? What does she think? Should the walls come down?
Yes. She thinks that, women should be able, if they can do it, they should be allowed to do it. She might be ahead of the curve. You know, she's the type of woman, she can do, 30 pull-ups. She can probably take the average guy. You have guys like, Rick Santorum and things like that. They're looking at, I think from their perspective, my wife can't do that, so therefore no women can do it. Or my daughter can't do that, so therefore, nobody's daughter can do it.
And what do you think, Jack? And these are your daughters in there. Here's Judy writes us on Facebook. She says Rick Santorum has no right to judge women's ability to serve on the front lines. But what about he makes the point that, well, men are trained to protect women, and so that, they'll be distracted by that rather than the combat mission itself.
Well, I'd rather have my daughter back me up in a bar situation than Rick Santorum. She could take Rick Santorum. I mean, she would make him tap out so quickly that, I would like to see him, go head to head with some of these women.
Jack, I appreciate your call, and I wish good luck to your daughters and thank them for the service. Robert McGinnis, there's a father who has two daughters in the thick of it, and you hear how he sees it. He'd rather be backed up by his daughter than, let's say, Rick Santorum. But, facetiousness aside, she's got the capacity. She wants to do it. He says let her defend the country.
Yeah, they're phenomenal women in terms of certainly what I've seen over the years. You know, we have never denied the fact that there are some great young women that are serving well. They have full capacity to do this. The question from a policy perspective is whether or not we want to treat young women as the same, and if there were a future draft, would we put them in the exact same positions as men? And you have to look at that and consider the ramifications. I listed the physical issues. I talked about the sexual issues. When you ask young women, certainly in the armed forces, and we stopped that here in the last few years, but before, and this is documented by the Army Research Council and also by the GAO, they say no. They say they should be allowed to volunteer. However, they should not be forced into those positions. And that's, I think, one of the cruxes of the issue. Will we in the future, because we have forgotten about these reasons why perhaps we should not do this, are we going to then put women in places that are going to not only hurt them, but jeopardize our overall ability to fight? And I'm concerned about that.
Robert McGinnis, I know we have to let you go today, but I very much appreciate your coming on. Thank you for your time and thoughts.
Well, thank you, Tom.
I want to come back to this issue about where this may go down the road, but a couple more calls first, Margaret and Kayla, if I may. Anne is calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Anne, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm the executive director of the Alston Wilk Society. One of the things that we do in South Carolina is we have facilities for formerly homeless veterans. I've been listening to all the conversation. And my father was a World War II vet. You know, women have been serving in capacities and wars that they haven't been getting credit for many, many, many years.
Mm.
And I have a former employee who leads 3,000 Army soldiers. I have a fellow Lander alumni, Lander University alumni, who is the Assistant Adjutant General of the National Guard in South Carolina, who is a female. Another caller made reference to something, it was Robert, about women getting pregnant. Don't want to be facetious, but it takes two people for somebody to get pregnant, and it shouldn't be all landed on the credit given to the woman or the discredit.
So as a woman who sees veterans and who knows something from your family about war, you say take the boundaries down?
Of course. I mean, it's just like anything else. You know, I fought for the ERA. I'm almost 62 years old. And women who were in the homes were angry because they said we wanted everybody to go to work. It was all about equality, just like this is. It's all about if you are a woman, and I could never do what these women do. I know that about me, therefore, I would never put myself in that position because I physically couldn't do it. But for the women who can and want to, just like the men who can and want to, then they should be given the opportunity. This thing of telling them they can't do something, and it's, by the way, the end result, in my opinion, of all this, it's really about power. It's who has the power. And if the women aren't given the ability to earn all of the awards and badges and courageous things that you can win, then they won't be, have the opportunity to become the generals and the all the, and all of the various
Certainly that's the case that's been made. Anne, I appreciate your call and thoughts very much. And let me get one more, if I may, here. Thank you, Anne. Iowa City, Iowa. Maria, you're on the air, Maria.
Hi, Tom.
Hello.
Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I come from a military family. My uncle was had the Silver Star at Iwo Jima. He was a Marine commander. My father was a paratrooper in New Guinea. My grandfather was a colonel in the Army, and my other uncle flew a B-17 in World War II. And I felt really cheated when I took a career aptitude or career interest test at 43 and found out that I should have been an Air Force officer. Mm-hmm. I have the personality profile of a field marshal. You know, I can't help being who I am, and that's what I, that's who I am. And yet those opportunities were denied to me. I think women will never have equality until they are considered equal, and there is no front line. Robert McGinnis is wrong. There is no front line in the kinds of wars we fight anymore, and I don't know what about the current wars that we're in would make him think that we are returning to conventional warfare. Obviously, we're engaged in guerrilla warfare. And I think his reactions are regressive, and he's cherry-picking the data that he wants to look at to prove that women shouldn't be in combat. I mean, you can't pick whether women are going to be in combat. The field, the front line is wherever the action is, and you can't predict ahead of time where that action is.
Maria, you sound like a field marshal to me, and I appreciate your call as well. Let me get another right here. Matt, Harrisonburg, Virginia. Matt, you're on the air. Thank you, Maria. Matt, you're on.
Hey, John, thanks for having me.
Yeah. What's your experience, Matt? What do you know?
Well, I'm in the Marine Corps, and I've spent 2 years, two tours in Iraq and one in Afghanistan. And the last caller is wrong. There is a very, very strong front line. Just getting back from Afghanistan this past fall, there are bases that never see combat. And there are some, like I've been, where we spend months and months and months out in the field with no showers. But I think the main question we have to ask here is not should women be in combat, but if they are, we have to up these basic prerequisites. Because right now, especially in the Marine Corps and all services, women have to do lower physical fitness tests, lower combat fitness tests. They can go slower. But when I'm in combat and I go down, I don't weigh any less because she's a female taking me out.
Right.
I'm not saying they shouldn't be allowed, but we need to up these very basic minimum requirements.
You mean if a female colleague had to carry you off the field if you were wounded, for example?
Exactly, yeah. Or hand me ammo cans that weigh 35, 40 pounds, some of them up to 50 or 60 pounds. If we require them to lift less of these for points, for instance, for the basic prerequisites, then we can't allow them in combat. And so they do the basic things that men do in training.
Matt, what about the idea that's been put forward here today that the individuals should be assessed on their own strength, not by their gender, but male and female? If they can do it, go for it. If they can't, don't.
Absolutely. I think that's a great idea, but I think that's a big hurdle that a lot of people are going to have to jump, because a lot of people, a lot of women I've met with in combat zones think that since their bodies are built differently than ours, that they should be allotted a slower run time, allotted less push-ups, allotted less, not all of them, but a lot of them still have that stigma that we have to overcome.
Right. Margaret and Kaylee, you're very patient. Let me get one more call, then I'll bring it all to you. Peter in Boston. Thank you, Matt, very much, and for your service. Peter, you're on the air.
Yeah, Tom, great show. Listen, one of your more conservative listeners, but kudos for the show. But I also happen to be a combat Marine, different war in Vietnam, and, mm-hmm. and we lost a lot in 1st Marine Division. We lost a lot of our people also with booby traps. But in the rear areas, a lot of people think, if you forget your history, south of Da Nang, we had a lot of booby traps. Villages where at nighttime they'd come out and there'd be booby traps.
Yep.
So I think that's first, a lot of where the women casualties, and they do a great job over there, are on these IEDs getting exploded. That's mm-hmm. that's convoy supply.
Yep.
What I think the big issue, right, is like this young other Marine said, is the combat arms, the guys who go into the infantry. Again, those are the minority in the Marine Corps that actually go in the infantry, the
right.
scout sniper, the infantry, is a big physicality that's required. And again, there are this, some women that can possibly do it, yes, but there's so very few. One of the things, for example, most people don't know, there's two in Marine boot camp. There's women Marine boot camp and men Marines.
Mm-hmm.
The physical strength requirements are much higher in the men Marines. You can't get through boot camp and join your infantry outfits without having gone through it.
They're but if a woman can do it, if they did the same training and they proved their physical capacity to the same degree, then would you say, all right, Peter, or not?
Well, I would, if a certain one, yeah, if they could, if certain women could do it, the problem what you have is like in a Fallujah or a Helmand. When you go in and you have 50, 75 casualties, you have to go back and pull whoever can do their job. You need, generally it's men
yeah.
who have been trained, you know, who have the physicality to then to go in and replace and, with the grunts. The final point is the woman, again, great credit to her, but is a little disingenuous. When the people are assigned as interpreters, they're not leading assaults. They're with the CP group. When an infantry outfit goes out and make an assault in Fallujah, they're back. They're there with everybody. Can they get killed? Sure, because anybody out there can get killed. But the front assaults, the ones who are doing the assaults into the building, those are the grunts. Those who are kicking the door down, those are the guys who are doing the trigger pulling and dying and killing. Those are the that's in the infantry. Those are the warriors who are up there doing it. You have just because you were an interpreter,
yep.
yes, you go out there and you can. It doesn't necessarily mean you were out there doing the assault. And I had many times with interpreters assigned to us. They came out and sure could they get shot because everybody else was.
Yep.
However, they didn't do the assault.
Peter, we've got it. Our time grows short. Kayla, first, just to that point. I mean, I you're very clear about what your role was there. Yes, it put you in the middle of a lot of bullets. Peter's saying, when it comes to the physicality, he still wants somebody who's proven that they can do it, you know, up front, kicking down the door, if that's what's required. You agree?
I've said all along that if there are physical requirements, they should be applied across the board. And right now, the physical requirements for men change as they get older. And if that means that older men can't be in the infantry anymore, then fine, apply that across the board. I completely agree with the previous caller that there are certain requirements and they should be applied universally. I'd also like to very briefly touch on Rick Santorum's point that that men are hardwired to protect women and,
mm-hmm.
and they might not be able to keep on the mission because of this issue. I find it completely baffling that we reserve our nation's highest honor for men who sacrifice their lives for their male comrades. If you fling yourself on a grenade to save your male comrades,
yep.
you're a hero. But if you were to do the same thing for your female comrades, that would be because they distracted you from the mission.
Hmm.
That doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Margaret, what about Robert McGinnis earlier saying, look, if we go further down this road, if we take all the walls down, you will eventually have conscription and you will have American women conscripted into the front lines of combat who may want nothing to do with that.
Tom, I find that fascinating because I see no direction towards a draft. We're facing a downsized force, so we'll have even less motivation to move to a draft. We have no problem recruiting into our force. Recruiting into a smaller force will be easier.
But somewhere down the road that could change. I mean, we all know that ebbs and flows over time.
it does ebb and flow, but we see at this point no direction towards a draft. And another point that he made about women's attitudes towards being forced into combat, treated like men, there's actually very robust data that shows that female officers, female NCOs, those that have committed to the military believe strongly that they should be treated just like their male peers, that they should be assigned to occupations just as their male peers are, to include combat.
Should there be any acknowledgement of the cultural history of not putting women in combat roles? Let's say there were a draft again. Would you be in favor of having them drafted to combat roles or not?
I would be in favor of having female service members treated just as their male service members as long as they were physically qualified to do the job.
We're in a situation today where fewer and fewer of our young people qualify for military service at all due to being so physically unfit, unfortunately, because of the obesity epidemic. And to make any additional requirements that keep women out of roles if they are physically fit enough seems to be a ridiculous way to limit the access of the military to the most qualified. I'd also like to add that in a survey at the Army War College in 2006, 74% of these mid-career Army officers believe that all troops should be allowed to serve for positions for which they are qualified, regardless of gender. Well, that's where we're going.
This is going to be very interesting to watch in the years ahead. I wonder what will happen with withdrawals from Iraq and Afghanistan if this trend stops in its tracks or just keeps going. Kayla Williams, you speak very clearly and out of some experience there as an interpreter in Iraq, as a sergeant, and we appreciate your being with us today, Kayla. Thanks for your thoughts.
Thank you for having me.
Margaret Harrell with the Center for New American Security. Thanks very much for being with us, Margaret.
It was my pleasure. Thank you, Tom.
Thanks to all of our listeners and callers. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.